All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Here we go again. We are keeping up, putting out a podcast every week. They said it couldn't be done and I'm doing it. It's amazing. It's another interview today. We have got Barry Grint, who, if you listened to the last episode where I spoke to the guys from The Kind, he was mentioned and I thought, yeah, I need to look him up, don't I? He's mentioned on a few Oasis sleeves. And so I found him and got in touch. And yeah, we booked it and recorded it within a couple of days, which was absolutely fantastic. A lot of these interviews, like, you know, I'm talking to people for weeks and months setting them up. So just to literally turn it around, record it, release it, instant karma style. It was fantastic. So I hope you guys enjoy that. It only really dawned on me when I was talking to him, like, I actually know nothing about mastering. Like, I understand mixing, but mastering, I just don't get it. So, so he was able to shed a bit of light on it. So hopefully you guys enjoy that. Also, what I thought I'd do today is I'm doing an episode with Richard at some point where we're going to be ranking every year the Oasis were active. So what was the best year to be an Oasis fan in terms of what they put out, the interviews, the gigs, you know, how good a year was it for an Oasis fan? So we're going to do that. But as I'm doing that, and as the interview with Barry was relatively short, like 30 odd minutes, so I thought, well, we don't like to leave you shortchanged here. So I thought what I would do is go through and give my favourite song for each year of Oasis. So from 1993, from when they had their first official release, which is not really an official release, I suppose, because Columbia was a white label demo in 1993, but starting with then and going through all the way to 2009, what was the best song released by Oasis or by one of the Gallagher brothers in those years? So that should be good fun. There's nothing's really happened news wise. One thing that did happen a while back that was big news, but I have nothing to do with it, is Noel Gallagher went on a date with a woman. So there you go, that's news. Other than that, it's all been very quiet. Liam's tweeted a little bit about football. Noel's announced a few more gigs in the summer. But except for that, we're relatively quiet. There's a good documentary series on at the moment. I watched the first one last week, which was cool. It's all about Britpop on Channel 5. And a few people on it have been on the podcast before. Alan McGee was on it. Ian Robertson was on it very, very briefly. John Robb has been on the podcast. And Angelie Dutt, Angelie Martin as she is now. Interestingly, I actually set that up. Angelie has no social media sort of presence and sort of generally stays quite quiet. But, you know, if you Google her, probably the interview that I did with her is one of the biggest things out there. So I've had a couple of messages over the years of people saying, I'm trying to get in touch with her. Can you do it? So it's almost like I'm her secretary, which is fine. I'm more than happy to provide that service. It was a good little documentary. I very much enjoyed it. And next week it's going to be moving on to, I think, 1995. So should be good fun. All right. Without any further Freddie ado, let's move on to this interview that I did with Barry Grint. And then wonderful. All right. Well, look, thank you for your time and welcome to the Oasis podcast, Barry Grint.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
And you were Bazza on email. Is Bazza better or Barry? What do you prefer?
Whatever you like. It buzzes just from the way I sign in the run-out groove on the records.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. Excellent, yeah.
That's just stuck over the years.
Fair enough. All right. Well, look, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been, it's always great when you get someone that's been named on an Oasis. One of my little tasks I've got is just get everyone that's been listed on Oasis credits on, and so you're there front and center on a number of them. Do you want to just let people know sort of where you were brought up and how you got into music and then sort of into what you do now?
I was born and grew up in South London. Always had an interest in the technical side of things, initially radio, and I was doing hospital radio for quite a few years, built studios for them as well as doing the odd program, had many, many jobs before starting as a runner at Trident Studios, which was between Wardour Street and Dean Street in Soho, very famous studio. In its day, started there as a runner. The house engineer was Flood, who is now a famous producer. Mm-hmm. It just happened that there was mastering in the building up on the third floor. I went up and saw what those guys were doing and thought, yeah, this is my sort of thing. And we used to do lots of tape copying back in the day. So if somebody mastered a track in the UK, then the tapes would be a master tape would be made with all of those mastering changes made. And then copies of that tape would be sent off all around the world to other territories so that they could cut from the tape that had the mastering on it. And so there was a tape copy room and you'd just be running out copies and also cassettes for promo and that sort of stuff. That was the next stage. They built another mastering room for doing transfers of mastered tapes coming in from other areas. And when they built the room, they put me in there doing that. So primarily I was doing work for Warner with their international acts, so Madonna and Prince and those sorts of things. So the tapes would come in and I then had to do a transfer for the UK and European market. And in theory, all of the hard work had been done. But in practice, the tapes, when they came over, they weren't being done very well. We used to have Dolby noise reduction, and sometimes you get a tape in and it would say it had Dolby and it didn't have Dolby, or it would say it didn't have Dolby and it did, or there'd be Dolby twice on one channel and not on the other. So they came in all of a bit of a mismatch, and generally just needed a little bit of tidying up, but it was really simple, straightforward stuff. And I would just spend all day cutting records, and that's how I really kind of got disc cutting under my belt. And then the two guys that were working day on and day off in the main room both left coincidentally quite close to one another, and the director said, do you think you can handle being the guy in the main room? And with the arrogance of youth, I just went, yeah, of course I can. and went in the main room and just haven't looked back.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. It's so interesting the way that kind of people have these journeys to then get there. And when we talk about mastering, just in a more general term, because I think a lot of people will see that remastered, on the certain recordings, especially when people are putting things out again, it will be like remastered 2014 or whatever. And I think it's quite, it's often, I'm not an audiophile, so I'm quite, people say, oh, you've got to listen on vinyl or you've got to listen on really good headphones or whatever. But to me personally, I'm really sorry if that's offending you, but you know, for me, I just can't really hear it that much, to be honest. It's whether or not I'm just not tuned into it. But I think I'm a bit more focused on the song. And it's only really, say, something like the recent Beatles reissues they've done with the remastering on the albums. And you can go, oh, I can hear the horns more clearly on Savoy Truffle, or I can hear this more clearly on this. I mean, do you want to just talk us through mastering, what you're physically trying to do? Are you just trying to make it clearer, or what's your ultimate aim when you're picking up something like that?
I think, in my view, the sole purpose of mastering is to present the music in the best possible light, doing whatever is required to achieve that. And remasters can be, for a number of different reasons, with some really old stuff, there are limitations in the equipment that was available at the time. Excuse me. There could be tape dropouts, you know, and it's more of a restoration than a remaster. Some remastering is more kind of reflecting how we expect things to sound today, so making them contemporary with today. And by that, I mean that if you listen to music over the years, the sound has changed over time. So records from the 60s didn't really have that much bass in them. They were quite sort of thin and middly, and that's partly in order to try and get the music to fit on the disc at that time. But then you go into kind of early 70s and some prog rock and that sort of stuff, and there's a lot of bass going on, and then disco, and there's lots of bright high-end guitar bands in the 2000s. You know, the expectation fluctuates. So I think with a lot of reissues, you're potentially re-evaluating something in today's light and making it contemporary to now. I think that's why reissues can be quite divisive. Some people cherish the sound that the music had when it first came out, and they want any technical faults to be corrected, but they don't really want it to be mucked about with. Whereas other people will go, oh, I really like it now. It sounds much better than it did back then.
Mm.
You know, everybody has their own taste.
But
certainly, as far as mastering is concerned, just try and present it in the best light you can.
Sure. And what does that mean? I mean, for instance, would you get notes from like the producer or the artist to say, oh, I really want the bass punchy on the middle eight section, or, you know, or is it like that, or is it more up to you to kind of think about it?
When I started, most mastering sessions were attended. There'd be somebody from the record company or the producer or the artist. And that made mastering quicker, probably, than it is today, because if you were going to head off in a particular direction with a track, you had somebody there and you could go, actually, what we could do this. Do you like that? And then they'll go, oh, yeah, let's follow that a bit further. Or, no, I don't like that. Whereas now there isn't so much tended work. And so you do a first attempt, for want of a better phrase, and then that gets sent off to whoever's, you know, running the project. And then they'll come back with notes. And it's a much slower still collaborative, but a much slower process of to and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they were in the room, you know, it would be done in a 2-second chat. Yes, no. You get there much quicker.
Mm.
And yeah. Going back to what you're saying about the tidying these things up and making them sound more contemporary. I know that there's in a film sort of world, you've got like the way that directors will go back and take kind of, you know, like George Lucas famously messing with Star Wars and things like that. And I know that going back to the Beatles again, that there was some criticism about some recent Beatles things where they'd gone even correcting mistakes. You know, like little notes where they'd gone out of key and things, and they just tweak that. Let's just put that back into key. And obviously with digital, you've got so much more ability to do that now. But then the true, like you're saying, the true hardcore fans go, no, you know, we like the fact he wavered on that note a little bit, because that was true. And we want the truth of what they physically did in the booth. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you prefer that kind of that taking the, you know, the original piece, or is it like, well, no, let's just, you know, make it perfect, really?
I don't really think that that's... It's not something that a mastering engineer decides on. You know, if somebody says we want this corrected, or they give you some direction, then our job is to achieve that. Unless you really think that there's a reason that they shouldn't be doing that, in which case you voice your view based on experience. And then it's up to them. And, you know, we are employees in this situation. And if the person paying the bills wants to do something, sure. then they call the shots.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So moving on to the Oasis side of it, obviously you'd had a good sort of decade behind you before they sort of come onto the scene. I mean, do you remember them sort of coming through and then to the first time you worked on any of their stuff?
Yeah, it's probably more like 2 decades. I can remember being at Abbey Road, and you know, there was a lot of buzz about the band, but Abbey Road was the sort of place where there was so much good stuff going through. Normally in an independent place, you'd kind of expect engineers to be fighting over various bands, because you know they're an up-and-coming band, or they're a big known band, and so they want to do the work. But there was just so much stuff that everybody got a share. And it just happened I was allocated the band when they were ready for mastering. I did the album Definitely Maybe, and we did the first 3 singles from what was going to be What's the Story.
Yeah.
Because the label wanted to, you know, keep some momentum going. And so I think there'd been a couple of releases off Definitely. Then the album came out, and then they wanted to, you know, have singles ready to go. So there was Roll With It, Whatever, and...
Some Might Say.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So those were all done in advance. And with Whatever, that was the last Oasis thing that I did. Before, in a bizarre set of circumstances, ended up leaving Abbey Road and going to be a presenter on radio. And so I mastered Whatever, and then I played Whatever on radio, having changed my career. that was just a record that at the time leapt out of the radio. Every time it was being played, you know, you just kind of went, wow. So, yeah, that was a memorable moment.
A lot has been sort of written and discussed about Owen Morris's brickwalling technique, that apparently when he got hold of Definitely Maybe, because it had had so many different sort of aborted sessions with different producers, and then Owen took the final sort of tapes that they were happy with and basically just turned everything up to 11. Now, is that a sort of apocryphal, or is that real, do you think? I mean, I know from editing audio on the podcast, when I'm putting in a song from the first sort of two or three Oasis albums, it tends to just be a block of audio. Whereas when you put in a song from another band, there's lots of peaks and troughs in sound. I mean, so just from that, it does feel true. But I mean, is there something specifically different that Owen did with that technique that affected your work?
Yeah. Owen went into Johnny Marr's studio. And in that studio, there was a DAT machine, a digital audio tape machine. A thing called a brawl limiter on it, which meant that you couldn't record above maximum. And so Owen drove his mixes quite hard into this DAT machine. And that's how he got more volume in his mixes. And then when he came in to do the mastering with me at Abbey Road, we repeated that kind of thing because there were no digital limiters back then. There was one kind of not very good early limiter in the mastering room. But basically, as he was sitting next to me and we were making changes at every opportunity, we were either going through the analog compressors or through this sort of digital limiter outboard thing and gradually increasing the amount of volume at each time. And then when we'd done, digital copies were made, and they were sent out to the territories, and it was Sony in America that were putting out the Oasis songs. And there was an engineer working in Sony's studio in New York, a chap called Vlado Mella, who's a mastering engineer. And he got in touch with his contemporary in the UK, a chap called Ray Staff, who was at Sony Studios. And Ray taught me to master. So he phoned me up and said, "I've just had Vlado on the phone, wants to know what the hell you've done, because it just looks like blocks." I went, "I did what the band wanted." And then, you know, within 6 months, Vlado was doing exactly the same thing, if not more.
Really?
And so it all kind of, you know, took off from there.
And that's literally an Oasis song will play louder than other songs, like on a jukebox. They said that the sort of a benefit of that was that if you're listening to an, if you're in the pub and the jukebox is playing, you know, everything else will be in the background, and an Oasis song comes on and it's just that much louder than everything else. I mean, is it purely a volume thing, or is it more in the overall scheme of the music?
I think there is an element of, because it was limited, so limiting makes the loud bits a bit quieter, the quieter bits a bit louder, so that the average volume is higher. It's a more consistent volume. So there is an element of that, but a lot of it is down to, you know, the way it's recorded, Owen's mixing, the way the guys perform. You know, there's no one single thing that will do that. I can tell you, in comparison today, the amount of volume on bass near as loud as we can achieve today with, you know, digital plugins and all of that sort of thing. But I think what it does have, it still retains some of the dynamics. So for want of a better phrase, things pop out. Whereas today, heavily limited tracks, they can just sound a bit flat. Nothing really changes. Nothing kind of keeps the ear interested. But that's certainly not the case with the Oasis material.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's brilliant. Did you notice a sort of a difference, having worked on Definitely Maybe, and then, you know, and then going into the, like, obviously Whatever was a big change because it was so much more string-based rather than just being in the band, and then going into the singles as well, some might say Roll With It. Did you, and you were doing the B-sides as well, I take it. So there's some acoustic-y tracks in there, like It's Better People and Talk Tonight and things like that. I mean, did you notice a sort of a change, and also did those different things give you different sort of challenges?
Yeah, I mean, yes, obviously as a listener, you kind of go, oh, that's a bit different. But an engineering perspective, you're not really listening in the same way as you do at home. You're just listening for things that are need change for whatever reason, technical reason. You're not really listening to a track. So, you know, sometimes I'm working on something with someone and they'll be in the room and you'd be working on it for, you know, a while, and we'll go, so what do you think of the track? And it sounds crazy, but you just go, oh, I don't know, hang on a minute, I'll have a listen. Because you're just not really listening in that way.
But
after the first album, those three singles, there was it evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And again, from my perspective, you know, Owen was doing a great job. It wasn't really a problem. It was just any final tweaks that he wanted done and getting them done. The only one thing I do remember is that on one version of one of the tracks, had a lot of strings in it. Can't remember which track it was. And there was a moment where Noel just came off the fret momentarily, and we edited out that little bit where he came off the fret, because Abbey Road had Sonic Solutions hard disk editing system. And to do that edit would have been impossible on tape, because you'd hear the edit go through on a long sustained note. But with the Sonic Solutions, we could just sort of cut either side, match the waveform up, smooth it over, and so it just sails through.
Mm. And so you just went and you just did that. You just carried on and smoothed it out.
Yeah. Because Owen knew it was there, and he said, "Can we try and correct that?"
That's interesting.
Yeah. Ah.
And then, so it was always Owen. Did you ever get Noel? Did Noel ever come into this, or did he ever have any input? Or do you think once it was done and mixed, it was just with Owen and that was it?
Yeah, it was just one session. Did the album? I think it was just one session. Maybe two. One session with Owen, and then maybe one session without.
Yeah,
it was, you know, kind of all over very quickly.
Nice and easy. Yes, a lot easier than the recording by the sounds of it, because the recordings tended to be a lot more difficult. It's better people love one another, because living your life can be tough. It's better people speak to each other, the shame is not enough. If everybody came alive and stayed alive and lived their lives instead, yeah. So come outside and feel the light, it's cold inside but it's lonely in your bed, in your bed. But yeah, and then obviously they've gone on to that album, and the stuff you worked from the second album went on to be absolutely huge. So was there was it an interesting thing for you to then see the rise of that band, having played your part in it?
I mean, you always want something that you've worked on to do well. I've done a lot of stuff over 39 years. I just don't really feel that, you know, I had really much part in how successful they were. I mean, you know, it's got to be, you know, 99% down to the band and the songs that they've written. And then the balance...
Hey, Barry, that's a very rare thing to hear from someone that's involved with Oasis. They're normally, it was all down to me. it wasn't for me. Yeah, so that's refreshing.
It's got to be the band, and it's got to be Owen. You know, yeah. they pulled it all together. I mean, I was pleased that it happened, and I was pleased for the guys. You know, the great songs, songs.
And then after that, that was it. There was, you know, Morning Glory was done separately, and then Be Here Now and ongoing from there. They just chose not to chose to go with someone else. Any particular?
I wasn't at Abbey Road. I'd left.
Oh, okay.
I'd gone to Be In Radio briefly.
Okay. Fine.
One of the things that did happen was that originally I Cut Definitely Maybe as a single album, because nobody had told us that it was going to be a double. And so I'd cut it as a single, went off on holiday, and when I came back, found that it had been recut as a double.
Okay. And is there much difference when you're cutting like the vinyl version? Do you have a different one for the vinyl, for the CD, and then for the digital recordings?
If we are cutting, well, if I'm cutting something that I've done the mastering on, then I will take off a lot of the extra limiting that's on there to get it up to a commercial digital volume, because it translates to vinyl better when it's a little bit more dynamic. But a lot of releases on vinyl are the same as the digital CD version, I won't go into the boring details of cutting vinyl, but it just means that the overall volume has to be lowered in order to get it to fit.
Okay.
There are certain things in vinyl. Sibilance can be a problem, stereo bass can be a problem, but we've tools to manage that.
So
that's not too much of an issue.
Okay. One other thing, I don't believe you physically did it, but there was What's the Story, Morning Glory had an SACD release. So it was sort of released in this sort of quadraphonic format, effectively. I don't believe you were involved in that, were you? But were you aware of that format as it came through, and did you get involved in that?
I was well aware of Super Audio CD, never asked to do anything.
Sure. It's interesting for us as fans and historians, because, you know, we would just love to get the raw kind of original tracks and be able to break down the different, you know, the different things. Whereas obviously Oasis don't tend to do that. They just tend to give you the, I know a lot of artists have then gone back and sort of even releasing the original stems and things. So you can kind of, you can do your own mixes almost. But yeah, well, that's one of the good things about Super Audio CD is that for those Morning Glory songs, you are able to then physically take out, ah, there's the bass, there's the whatever, and be able to play with it. And that's such a pleasure. But yeah, as I say, as a format, it didn't take off. Must be nice when you physically are mastering. Do you have, like, you know, the mixing desk in front of you?
Yeah, so there's the mastering desk in front, but the changes we're making are done more in a frequency adjustment
way.
So we don't have a fader with the kick or a fader with the vocal or that sort of thing. Sometimes we will get stems sent. And so we may have an instrumental and an a cappella, and we can blend them how we think in order to achieve a result. But most of the time we get a stereo track. And if you want to lift the kick drum, then you'll just lift around the kick drum area with some EQ, you know, 72 hertz around there, and then just give that a lift just to put a bit more emphasis on what the kick's doing. That's principally what's going on in mastering.
Fair enough. And does it, so I've often thought this, you know, when obviously if someone's got a stereo and they can change their own bass and treble and things, does it annoy you as someone that's done the mastering and has got these things exactly how you want it, if someone's then putting the bass up too high or treble? No, that's not how we did it.
No. I don't really get exercised by how people listen, whether something is on a digital format or an analog format, you know, whether one speaker's on the bookshelf and the other one's tucked under the settee. All I want is for people to enjoy the music. There are some people that take a more technical interest, which is absolutely great, but just so long as everybody's enjoying the music that they're getting.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, that's great. The one thing, I mean, the reason why you're someone I've been meaning to look up for years, and then you popped up on our radar because I interviewed the guys from The Kind recently, and you've been working on their album. So was that good fun to work with them?
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably do it every 20 or 30 years, I think. So what had happened was that, as I say, I left Abbey Road, went into commercial radio as a presenter for a little while, and realised that that was even less secure than the music industry is, and so started Alchemy Mastering. And one of the early bands through the door was The Kind. So did some tracks with them. They were managed by a guy called Rick, and he took the masters that I'd made and made a CD for me when making CDs was still something relatively new. And so that just kind of stuck in my mind. And then the guys got in touch and said, we're getting back together, we're putting some more stuff out. We have to come and do the mastering session with you. And it was great. It was great to see the guys again. They're really, really good guys.
Cool. All right. Well, look, it's been fascinating for me today. I'm sorry if, you know, obviously I've got such a limited knowledge of what you do. So I'm sorry if that comes across like a noob, as the kids would say. But no, it's been fascinating. Is there a particular Oasis song from either that you've worked on, that you've heard over the years, that you think is particularly special? We always end with a song from the band. So anything that jumps out?
Well, I think for me, it has to be Whatever. At the time that it came out, Radio 1 was still on medium wave. And they had a protection device for the transmitters called an OptiMod. And it had it would turn the sound down if it got beyond a safe level for the transmitter. And so if something triggered it, it would close it down really quickly, and then really slowly the sound would come back up again. And the thing with particularly with Whatever, excuse me, was that because it was so controlled, the volume was so controlled on it, it could be played louder without it being a problem for the transmitters at all. And so that's why it just really, you know, came across so well on the radio.
Yeah.
For me, I think there are so many to choose from, but on a personal basis, it's got to be Whatever.
Fantastic. All right. Well, look, we'll end with that. Barry, thank you so much for your time. So if people want to get in touch, you're what, at Bazagrint on Twitter?
Yeah.
And then, if people want to use you for Alchemy Studios, then they could get in touch, or Alchemy Mastering, sorry.
Alchemy has now been bought by Air Studios, George Martin's old studio. And so now it's barry@airstudios.com.
There we go. Wonderful. Barry, thank you so much for your time, and all the best.
Great. Lovely to meet you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. It was really interesting to talk to Barry. As I said, I learned a lot. I still don't quite understand how mastering works. I'd love to actually sit there and go through it and sort of watch them, whatever they do with the faders or whatever, and messing around with frequencies. Mm-hmm. I mentioned on the Discord about mastering, and a few of the guys who've in bands just said, I haven't got a clue what they do. I send it off to them. It comes back. It sounds better. That's all I need to know. And so, they do their magic. I don't know what they do, but they make it sound amazing. So well done, the people of the mastering world. All right, let's talk about the best song of the year by an Oasis member in each of the years they were releasing songs, shall we? So obviously we start off in 1993, and there was only one official song released in that year. So for the first time ever, I'm going to say that something positive about Columbia, in that it was the best song released by Oasis in 1993, because it was the only song released by Oasis in 1993. Obviously, there was other stuff happening in 93. For instance, the first radio session, Hit the North, happened then. And a lot of those tracks did end up getting released later on as B-sides. In terms of an official release from 1993, Columbia being posted out to record companies was pretty much the only thing. 1994, I have gone with Slide Away. Obviously, plenty of options in 1994. We've got the whole Definitely Maybe album, plus all the B-sides from all those singles, plus the whatever B-sides as well. So amazing array of songs to choose from 1994. And I've gone with Slide Away. I mean, it's sort of, if you're looking at my kind of ranking, I think Slide Away I had in second. So you can't argue with that. Cigarettes Now Coal is also one of my favourites from that year, but I'm going to go with Slide Away. Okay, 1995, once again, another incredible year. You've got all of the Morning Glory album and all of the singles from the Morning Glory album. So an amazing year with loads and loads of incredible releases. And when I look at my ranking, actually, the vast majority of the songs on that are from in the top sort of 20 are from 1995. So that is really, for me, an amazing year for Oasis. And yeah, I could have chosen from so many of those songs. But, you know, I'm going to have to go with the one that I picked as the best Oasis song, which did come out in 1995 on the album. So we're going to go with Don't Look Back in Anger. All right, slightly less to choose from in 1996, because the only official releases in 96 were the B-sides of Don't Look Back in Anger. So there's only really three tracks to choose from there. I mean, there was other stuff going on. There's other collaborations and things, but I have gone with Come On, Feel the Noise. I absolutely love that song, as I've talked about on here numerous times. Yes, it's a cover, but it's an absolutely incredible cover that is just peak Oasis. So best song of 1996, without a huge amount of competition, is Come On, Feel the Noise. All right, 1997 is another excellent year with lots and lots of choices. We've got the B-sides from the first two singles to come from Be Here Now and the whole Be Here Now album as well. And so I'm going to go with Stay Young. B-sides, did you know what I mean? Had to be one of my favourite Oasis songs. The theme of the Oasis podcast. It means a lot, so it's got to be my favourite song of 1997. Once again, we are a little bit limited. The only official releases were the B-sides from the All Around the World single. And so from there, it was a bit of a toss-up because I really like those B-sides. But I'm going to go with Street Fighting Man. Incredible cover. Better than the Stones version for me. Liam's absolutely tearing it up. The guitars sound amazing. So yeah. Love this cover version of the Stones original. Street Fighting Man is my best song of 1998. 1999 was a little bit more limited in what we had available. No official Oasis releases because they were sort of hunkering down and recording the next album. And then going through the various lineup changes and stuff. But there were a few collaborations this year. And my favourite collaboration from those is Carnation. Carnation, which was billed as Steve Craddock and Liam Gallagher for the Jam, Fire and Skill tribute album. And I love this. Liam's voice sounds amazing. The psychedelic production. It's absolutely brilliant. Great track, brilliantly recorded, great vocal. My song of 1999. Okay, 2000 is another year with loads of different options open to us. We have the B-sides from the Standing on the Shoulder singles, plus we have the whole Standing on the Shoulder album. And I'm going to go with Let's All Make Believe, a B-side from the Go Let It Out single. As I've talked about here a number of times, it always comes up very high on my rankings. It's a really special song. Brilliantly arranged, very meaningful, very touching, and with a sort of weird darkness about it. So yeah, it's something a bit different from the Oasis catalogue and one that always sticks out. So yeah, that is my song of 2000. So let's all make believe that we're still friends and we like each other. In 2001, we are very limited because they really didn't do very much at all. I mean, they had the tour of Brotherly Love going on. There was a couple of guest appearances and things like that. And what I'm going to go with is Noel Gallagher at the Steve Marriott tribute concert playing and singing lead vocal on Here Comes the Nice. So, yeah, I love the Small Faces. It's not necessarily one of my favourite Small Faces songs, but yeah, Noel doing a lead vocal with an all-star band backing him. So yeah, let's go. Here Comes the Nice for 2001.
This one's called Here Comes the Nice. 1, 2, 3, 4.
For 2002, we have lots of choices again. We have the whole Heathen Chemistry album and all the B-sides. And I'm going to go for one of the B-sides. I'm going to go Idler's Dream. I love this track. I think it's really beautiful. There's some very, very good songs on Heathen Chemistry and around the other B-sides as well. But I think Idler's Dream just pips them just for the beauty of the song. It's such an unusual song. You don't tend to hear sort of Noel in that sort of just with the piano backing like that. So yeah, I think that's worth a shout for best song of 2002. My heart, it skips a beat when I behold the light that's shining through your eyes of gold. From heavenly blood you seem to spring.
from heavenly waters you can drink.
2003 is another year when we have very limited releases. The only thing we really have is the fact that the Songbird single came out in 2003. And so with that, we have the B-side, You Got the Heart of a Star. And I'm very happy to have that as a song of the year because I think it's a really, really gorgeous song with that sort of brass sort of backing and everything. And once again, it's a brilliant Noel vocal, a lovely kind of message to it. So, yeah, a really special one. Come on, my brothers and sisters. You Got the Heart of a Star is the song of 2003.
You're never gonna get it on and be someone stuck in that crowd. So you call out for feelings. You hope that don't never exist. But don't be ashamed of your bones.
. 2004 is another year with no official Oasis releases, so it's only really the collaborations. And the collaboration for me, the best song of that year is Shoot Down, the Prodigy tune that features Liam and Noel. And this is a great song. This is like got such a drive to it, and it's sort of just so aggressive, and Liam's vocal is great. And the guitars and everything and the beats, it's just fantastic. I love the Prodigy. So Prodigy and Oasis together was always going to be special. And this doesn't let us down at all. 2004, Shoot Down. Something count. Something count and a bang, bang, bang. Something count. Something count and a bang, bang, bang. Something count. In 2005, we have the Don't Believe the Truth album and B-sides. And this is a tricky one. As I say, there's a lot of songs on Don't Believe the Truth that I really like, and a lot of the B-sides as well. And so I've just gone with the song that I think is the best song from this era, which is The Importance of Being Idle. I don't think you can really argue with it. I mean, it was a number one single. And it's just so well put together. It's a really interesting melody, and it's quirky and it's different, and it jumps out when you listen to it. It really was a standout track at the time, and it still holds up today. Yeah, very special song, very interesting, different, and yeah, the best song I think of that era in 2005. . 2006, another year with no official releases. So what I've gone with is to promote the Stop the Clocks compilation, Noel and Gem and Terry Kirkbride went out and did a tour sort of doing acoustic stuff. It's acoustic. It was a bit of electric guitar in it, but you know what I mean? Just the three of them just went and played a lot of gigs and did some radio sessions and stuff. And from that tour, they did a whole range of different tracks from the Oasis back catalogue, but they also did a cover of the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever that I really, really enjoyed. So let's go with the Strawberry Fields Forever as played by Noel and Gem and Terry.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to stop at the fields. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry.
All right, 2007, another relatively quiet year. However, we did have the film, Lord Don't Slow Me Down. And with that, we then also had the track, Lord Don't Slow Me Down. So we're going to go with that because there's not much else to choose from. But it was a fantastic piece of work. The other option for me from this year was Within You, Without You. The track that Oasis did for the sort of BBC Sgt. Pepper documentary thing. That was right up there as well. And it was a really, really tough choice. But I'm going to just about favour Lord Don't Slow Me Down. And although it's never been an official release, let's go with the Liam vocal version. Because Liam should always have sung this. No idea why they ended up going with the Noel version. But yeah. Liam doing Lord Don't Slow Me Down is my track for 2007. Okay, 2008 is another one where we've got plenty of options because it's the release of the Dig Out Your Soul album and the first couple of singles from it. And I'm going to go with The Turning from the album. This is a fantastic, great, kind of psychedelic, moody, excellent song. Great lyrics, really well put together, really brilliantly produced. Liam's voice is excellent. And yeah, and it's just a really great part where it sits in that album in those first few tracks that are absolutely killer. Yes, the album falls off a little bit in the second half, but this was really, really special. And for me, like Oasis hitting a peak in the end of their career. But yeah, so love this track. 2008, The Turning. And then into the last year, so 2009, we had a couple of options, really, because they released the Falling Down single. So that had the B-side of Those Swollen Hand Blues. Plus, then there was the release of the EP release of Boy With The Blues, which also included I Believe In All. Neither of those I think are particularly good. I know they've got fans, especially Boy With The Blues, I think has got a certain fan base, but for me, I'm going to go with Those Swollen Hand Blues. It's such a quirky, weird song, and yeah, it's a very different sort of thing for sort of Noel to be doing. So yeah, it's always been one that it's not one I've sort of run out and listened to, but I think is a overall better song than the other two. And so, yeah, Those Swollen Hand Blues is a fun choice for my best Oasis-related song of 2009. Hope we'll be right back. So there we go. Was I completely off? Do you completely disagree with those choices? Feel free to get in touch and let me know. And that will do it for today. So thank you very much for listening. Thanks to Barry Grint for getting involved. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post bonus episodes and other general stuff. Also, there's the ability to get involved in the Discord, which is the way to, you know, if you do want to be involved in the sort of the phone-in episodes, that tends to be how I sort of arrange them, because they're the people that are like on the regular, being in contact. I say stay in touch and stay engaged, and that's really the, you know, where the regulars hang out. So yeah, if you love the podcast, you want to be more part of the community, then that is really the way to do it. Sign up to the Patreon and join the Discord. So yeah, there's been a few people have joined recently. There's plenty of chat goes on there every day, and it's good fun. All right, well, that will do it for today. Thank you very much for listening. Feel free to drop me an email, oasispod@gmail.com. Follow on social media. And as ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young. We'll be right back.